Good afternoon.
Welcome to Why Is This a Thing? The final week of September 11th.
And that's it.
That's it. Oh, that's I thought maybe the song would keep going or something. I don't know.
I feel like it's gotten shorter and shorter for every week. Just,
that would be a great bit.
That's it.
It's just... That's a good bit. I like that.
This is it. This is the end of the road here. We've done 4 weeks of musicals. This is the fifth, and then we're done.
No more podcasts ever.
Right.
I keep teasing that. No more podcasts ever. This is the last one, guys.
Oh, we got the sweet spots coming.
Yeah. Oh, our hecklers would love that, wouldn't they?
They love to silence us. Cancel culture is coming for Wattat.
We will not be silenced.
We have done some bad shit on this pod, guys. Let's just be honest. We deserve to be canceled.
No.
Well,
some people would say that.
Well,
definitely.
Maybe.
Anyone that would like to see us suffer for the rest of our lives, I would encourage you to do one thing. Comb through every episode of this podcast.
You're bound to find something. Between Nick's questionable cultural appropriation with the Japanese, Nico's racism.
What? Listen, I'm guilty of many things. Racism is very low on that list.
But it's on the list.
Okay, anyway. Hi. Welcome to the show. It's easy like What's Sunday up? Morning over here. How are we? We need to do a Dave draft at some point.
Yeah, we do.
I keep forgetting about this, but... let's pick a name and do it next week, right?
I suggested Mike. I think you said John, but I think we got to save that because it's way too big. So,
John's tough. What do you think about a John draft, Nick?
There's so many Johns.
Yeah, I mean, maybe.
That's like a super draft.
That has to be like the last one we do.
That's a big one.
John is tough.
Yeah, I don't know.
Maybe on that one, we actually make a strict rule, like, you need one, like, entertainer, like, one comedian, one musician, one athlete. Like, maybe we really...
Oh, right. Yeah, we've been talking about doing that, actually, like, putting positions in.
Yeah,
well,
that's not a bad idea.
At least for that one, that might be necessary, just to kind of, you know, make the choices a little tougher.
I also think you broaden it to five, because there's got to be that many.
Oh, I think more.
Yeah.
I think, yeah, definitely more. Anyway, put a pin in that. We'll do it next week for the spooktacular. Right around the corner, guys.
Okay.
You know, this is a good idea. One John draft a month.
One Dave draft a month. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Sure.
I think so.
Okay.
So, what's happening? How are we? Are we good?
We're jolly.
Yeah?
Dandy. Yet again.
The cat's hanging with us
today. We have a cat in here. It's a live beast.
First pussy to ever enter this studio.
Not true.
That's not true. Also.
Very not true.
Also mildly offensive.
Well, first affectionate pussy, at least. Into the.
I'm not going to comment. I had something to say, but.
What's up, bud? You want to come on the mic? About it.
Yeah, he's also a boy cat. I don't think Nico did not know that for a while.
That is a fierce pussy.
Didn't know it, but then I was...
Then he got LASIK.
Oh, yeah. We have shared the LASIK story. Enough with the LASIK.
I think it's my favorite punchline. And now he can see. You know?
The cat is now on the window. Man, are you going to be making noise the whole show?
I think he is. We can't kick him out, though. He's now officially part of the show.
What's up, buddy?
Hey, dude.
What's going on, bud?
He's like, let me have it back. Give me the curtain.
Okay. Yeah. I'll try to ignore the cat.
The light is going to knock down and knock you out.
Oh, he is going to knock down
the light. The hair light's going to kill you.
God. Death by hair light.
Oh, no. You'll be fine. We'll pile on through even though you're knocked out. Don't worry about it.
All right, let's talk this movie. Phantom of the Paradise is the name of the movie. It's directed by Brian De Palma. It is a movie that I have been recommended in the past for this show, and for some reason I just forgot about it. Joe DeFeo, big fan of this. We probably should have invited him on for this podcast.
Yeah.
Because he was the first person that told me, you got to see this Phantom of the Paradise. You will not be sorry. And truthfully enough, I am not sorry today.
Me neither.
Not sorry at all. What did you think? Phantom of the Paradise.
I loved it.
Loved it too.
I loved it.
Loved it.
Loved it.
High five.
Yeah, bizarre.
This movie rules.
Yeah, it's fucking awesome.
This movie's so good.
I don't know if I understood it enough to love it. I don't know. I mean, I feel like I'm still in like the sort of dating phase. I'm not sure yet.
Oh.
You know?
What did this movie do that was so wrong?
No, I don't have any. I don't have any, you know, reproaches or anything. But normally when I write notes while I'm watching a movie for this podcast, right, there's usually one of two ways they go. Either one or three ways. One is I don't have any fucking notes at all.
Mm.
And that's worst case scenario.
That's my approach.
that's my approach.
That's yes, yeah. Extemporaneous. That's what they are. Extemporaneous notes.
The other one is I have like a lot of like interesting thoughts or like, oh, this moment really stuck out to me and here's what I want to say about it, etc. And then like what happened with this movie, which is where I just write the plot because I don't know what else to write. I have no clue what to say about this movie.
The plot. That's the most interesting thing you derive
no,
from.
No, but it's the thing that I need to remember in order because that's my job. When you guys say, all right, Nick, tell me the plot. Like, I need to know the plot.
Yes.
But that's all I could write because I didn't really know what else to like say.
Yeah.
It's just so bizarre. And I guess this is the first. I'm looking at De Palma's career here because I'm so confused by this movie.
Okay.
So I'm like, all okay. Right, De Palma, they're talking about him. I've heard the name before. I go, okay, yeah. Oh, yeah, Scarface, Carrie, right. Okay, Mission Impossible, got it, yeah. He made this? Huh?
Yeah.
Okay, all right, this is the larger conversation, I guess. Because, it's a Brian De Palma movie. It's a 1974 Brian De Palma movie. That date, to me, is significant for
very
two
important.
Reasons.
Well, it's a year before Rocky Horror.
All right. So, exactly. Number
Which
one.
Which is a big thing.
No, thanks for stepping over my little
No, no problem. I
appreciate it. Thanks for fucking... Do I have the fucking car crash?
you were just That's going with car. The Rocky Horror Picture Show route?
That
I'm
was
rolling.
One of his.
Don't break my flow. It's like, what was the John Belushi line is John Belushi in fucking Animal House? When the Germans bombed Pearl Harbor?
Was it over on the Germans bombed Pearl Harbor? What's he saying? Forget it. He's rolling.
Forget it. He's rolling. I'm rolling. I got to get that over the soundboard.
That's such a
Yes, number one, it is an early De Palma picture. So he had just made the horror movie Sisters, which was a moderate success in, I believe, 1972, maybe. And before that, I mean, he's got movies like Hi, Mom, and The Wedding Party, and
Murder a la Mod, Dionysus in 69.
Yes, which,
Greetings.
He's got some, Greetings is an X-rated film. I mean, so he's got, like, some really, like, sort of fringe indie stuff, and in some cases, pornographic stuff. And so, 1974, he is starting to get a little bit of a budget. I think this one cost him in the ballpark of $1 million, $1.2 million, something like that. So it's pre-Obsession, it's pre-Dressed to Kill, it's pre-Carrie, it's pre-Blowout, right? So that's the first thing to know. And number two, as you just said, Nick, it is a year before the Rocky Horror Picture Show, which is surprising. It's one of those things where it's like, you assume that this is a bad imitator of Rocky Horror when really Rocky Horror was a bad imitator of this.
Right. The first thing I did watching this movie was look up when the hell did Rocky Horror Picture come out, because it just struck me visually, like the trailer struck me visually as like the same note.
Sure. Sure. And although this is not a straight musical in, I guess, the textbook definition.
I wouldn't really call it a musical at all.
Yeah, you can quibble with it.
And Adam made a great point. It's about as much a musical as the first Hairspray, which is very fair.
I think it's a little more than that. Like, I think the musical numbers are a little more sustained, and there are fantasy sequences where people are singing songs that are non-performative. So,
sort
like,
of.
I think the mystical elements of this sort of makes it you know, more of a musical than Hairspray.
Fit more, I suppose, even though, yes, it's technically not a musical.
The cat is making a break for it.
Oh, there he goes. He's opening the door.
Let him out. Let him out.
Hold on. He can do it. He did it.
Oh.
He's out.
He got it. He got away. All right, close the door.
All right.
We made the cat open it just to shut it behind his ass. Yeah, so, you know, but it's not as much a musical as Rocky Horror Picture Show is. But I think they both have the same sort of 70s gaudiness, the same sort of cult sensibility. I mean, similar to Rocky Horror, you see this thing and you're like, oh, this is destined to be a cult classic in 20 years.
I was struck by it because I was watching it. I mean, I think everyone who watches this and is a cinephile immediately connects it with Rocky Horror Picture Show, as I did. Mm-hmm. I also immediately, right off the bat, I was connecting it with Suspiria. It kind of has that like similarly gaudy and colorful presentation with even some of the same lighting choices. But very surprisingly, it came out 3 years before. But the moment I realized it was kind of reminding me of Suspiria, partially because of the setting. But I don't know. It was just this very like cool little moment. But like about 3 seconds later, when I made that connection, Jessica Harper shows up.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And she's
in
Suspiria.
Yeah.
It was like it was a very surreal moment. But I don't know.
She's wonderful.
She's fantastic.
She's really good in this movie.
But the fact that she did both of those movies.
Yeah.
Just like what the '70s were doing to actors' choices at the time. The fact that they would do a movie like this and then a movie like that. Mm. Oh boy.
So. Timing is interesting. If you have seen the Brian De Palma documentary directed by Noah Baumbach, I think you can stream it on Amazon. I could be wrong about that. Find it if you are interested in film in any way. It is just a sort of no bullshit look behind the lens on some of the greatest movies ever made. De Palma sits there, just tells a bunch of stories, and there is no other talking head in the entire movie. There's not a single other person interviewed. It's Noah Baumbach sitting in De Palma's apartment, and he's just recounting the stories of, oh, yeah, you know, when I did Dress to Kill, like the censors tried giving me an X rating, and I had to cut out X, Y, and Z scene. And, you know, the scene in Scarface, George Lucas showed up, and he actually, like, helped me direct, or, you know, like, I was sitting there as Marty was screening the first cut of Mean Streets, and he's just got all these stories, and he just tell, and who knows if they're accurate. I mean, you probably want to fact check against a couple other sources, but it is like such a refreshing behind the scenes look, because Brian De Palma is such a no bullshit, straight to the point type of speaker.
Surprisingly unpretentious.
Yes.
Because I can see why you would look at many De Palma films and find them extremely pretentious, but when you talk to the guy, he's very matter-of-fact about just his interests.
I'm not sure a lot of his films are that pretentious.
No, I wouldn't say so either, but I could understand why someone would watch many of them and think, oh, God, you're being so swishy and gaudy.
But not pretentious.
I think they confuse the two sometimes, though, in my opinion. I could understand why you would certainly watch something like this and find it pretentious here and there, even though I don't think it is at all, at all, you know. But certainly his earlier work. I mean, he comes from basically like the art district in New York, and that's where he surrounded himself for years, and he's just making movies about all those weirdos. So that's why you get something in a way like Murder a la Mod, or more specifically Dionysus in 69, which is just like a sex show about like a Greek tragedy, essentially. And this movie feels like you were brought into one of those clubs, but it was being funded by Hollywood. So everything about it in terms of like the production value is Hollywood, but the content is entirely like Soho in the 1970s, and it's remarkable.
And it's also PG, which is crazy that they were able to get this in under the wire, because there are scenes of like explicit violence towards the end that are sort of shot around in order to make it palatable.
There's also like a lot of like implications of like rape and sexual assault.
Yes. Very offhandedly, too. It's very strange.
But it's a De Palma movie, though. Like, De Palma is known for erotic thrillers. I mean, the later part of his career, there were, you know, three or four classic erotic thrillers that he made. I don't think I've ever thought of De Palma as a guy that pulls punches or you know, tries to cut it down so the censors are okay with a PG. The guy made Scarface, for God's sake. But it is kind of I hate to say that it was destined to fail from the get-go, but like, yeah, you see this thing and it's like, of course it's gonna make like $120 at the box office. You know?
It made nothing.
Yeah.
It made nothing.
What but is it was nominated for awards. I mean, like, it wasn't completely unrecognized.
Best original score.
Well, the movie
at the Oscars.
Right.
Oh, that's all it was nominated. You give it a production a design nomination. Jesus. But this movie's like exquisite. I just think, what is palatable about this thing? Seriously. I mean, my God, you can't. It's an impossible movie to recommend. I would never, ever show this to anybody unless they were you people. Yeah. And that's it. And even then, I understand like the wide span of reactions. Like, this is not one of those movies that elicits a middle of the road reaction. I understand if you're going to just get it, like, ooh, I respond to this voice and the artistry on display here and just this visionary doing his thing, or what the fuck is this? Mm. Get it away from me, please. Like, in the way that you react to
a cockroach,
Annette, or yeah, a cockroach. No, yeah, okay, that's
how
a great
I
point.
Reacted to it a little
that's
bit.
That's a great point. Like, in the way you see a spider and you're just like, whoop, no, I'm jumping away from that. Yeah.
Yeah, I feel sorry for you if that's the case, because I just thought this movie was a blast. Like, I just thought, like,
it's a joy.
De Palma is directing his ass off, as he usually is. You know, on some levels, it's a De Palma movie. On some levels, it's not. Like, I think, like, the Paul Williams aspect of it definitely changed the tone. And, you know, I wouldn't necessarily call this a Paul Williams, like, passion project, or, like, I wouldn't call it Paul Williams' thing, but he definitely takes about 30% of the ownership back.
Well, is that the case, or is it De Palma realizing Paul Williams' thing, and he's like, I have this story that's perfect for you?
Well, it's interesting, because Paul Williams talks about this. I just read an interview that he did on the 45th anniversary, or 50th anniversary, or however long it's been. But he was asked, like, how this came about, why De Palma cast him, and he's like, I really don't know, because there was not a job at the time that I was less qualified for. Uh-huh. It's like, he had just sort of made folksy, like, you know, had he worked on the Muppet movie yet? Not yet, right? But, you know, he had worked on maybe the Bugsy Malone score. Like, he had done, like, really, like, soft edge, non-rock stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, and he had written movies for like a bunch of like, or written songs for like a bunch of like doo-wop groups and like, you know, like pop groups in the 50s and 60s. So not a rock guy at all by any stretch of the imagination. And he's like, I don't know why anybody thought I would be able to write rock music competently. But the key with Paul Williams, and I think why he's so brilliant, and the music in this is so brilliant.
Mm. Music is great.
The music is phenomenal.
Yeah.
Is that he's just a chameleon. He's one of like those old school songwriter chameleons that can just bob in and out of different genres and parody and pay homage and make fun of, but also do the genres well. That scene where, you know, Swan, played by Paul Williams, the head of this record company, is sitting on the desk and sort of rotating around him in this 360 shot. You go through all the different genres singing the same song. I think that song is called The Phantom's Theme. I have to look at the soundtrack. I'd actually like to play some of it on here too.
Really,
the song's really good. But in that sequence, all of these different musicians, you have this like R&B trio, all female R&B trio, and you have this country singer, and you have this hard rock singer, and you go through all of the genres and you're like, this guy just gets music. And there's like so few people like that. And it's one of the reasons why, like, I'm such a big Paul Williams fan, and I think he's just a national treasure, is that, you know, he's the type of guy that can play, you know, the hard rock songs in this movie and also write Rainbow Connection for the fucking Muppets. Yeah. You know what I'm saying?
That's what the character needs to be, though.
Yeah.
It's exactly what the character, which is why I don't know. It seems very De Palma for me. I don't know how to pin down any of these decisions aside from De Palma. It feels like, yeah, the choices are incredibly weird, but they feel consistent within that person's vision. Mm. So it's like, there's nothing objective about this movie. It's entirely from the point of view of like one specific person, which is why like that choice feels like something Brian De Palma might have done. Because there's a billion ways you could visualize a scene like the one you just described. you could just have him, like, you know, flipping through a book of artists and cutting back and forth. There's, you know, a lot of weird ways to do that. But De Palma says, let's play with the fantastical route that I've established and have the choices literally spin around the room like we're in his head.
Yeah.
And come to this one beautiful moment with, like, this hard rock guy. Yeah.
We're different radio stations on a dial, essentially.
Yeah. That's a very directorial decision. I don't see Paul Williams saying, oh, why don't we have the room spin? See,
now, it's interesting that you say that because, like, I at times found it difficult to judge whether or not this movie, I don't want to say whether or not it was being fantastical, but the fantastical elements could have just as easily been literal, and I would have believed it because of the character, right? Sure. This guy had so much money and power that his world was fantastical in a way. He had such control over people that how do we know he didn't actually have people waiting in each corner of the room for their fucking cue? Like, I would believe it.
I guess.
Do you know what I mean?
He's that much of a monster. Just well, but
throughout the
corruption.
Throughout the film, they keep doing things like that. That almost kind of like leads me to that idea.
I would hope by the end when they get to the room with all the celluloid that you would be like, okay, this is a fucking fantasy.
No, but I see what you mean. It's an exaggerated form of reality, right? Yeah. I mean, that's the it's satire. They are parodying. They are satirizing the music industry. So it is, you know, literalizing this idea of selling away your soul to the record company.
There's nothing subtle about this movie in any way.
It is very not subtle, but I didn't mind it, to be honest with you. Like,
this is case in point. I'm like, give me like less subtlety if you know how to wrangle that, you know?
You can
wrangle it in an interesting way and express yourself through that like conflict of figuring this subject out. Just do it.
Well, part of it is also a non-pretentiousness, too, right? Like, it's you don't feel like you're being lectured to. You feel like the primary goal of this movie is to entertain. And then we can get, you know, with the heavy-handed commentary. I think that's ultimately what it comes down to, is most movies that have this sort of heavy-handed commentary in there forget how to be entertaining. And so all you're stuck with is the lecture, and then it falls flat and it just feels like someone's talking in your ear.
I hate it. I hate that so much.
This is just like an alive, just like visceral experience with a lot of intentionality behind the camera too. Like, that's the thing about De Palma. And it's one of the things that's actually underrated when you look at him in relation to his peers, when you look at him in relation to the Lucases of the world, the Spielbergs of the world, the Scorseses of the world. There's so much intentionality to every decision that he makes. And you just don't fucking get that anymore on the studio level at all. And he was doing this for 30 years. I'm not the biggest De Palma fan. There are some people that are like, they worship at the altar of this guy and they think he's one of the great American auteurs of all time.
One by the name of Tarantino.
Sure. Quentin Tarantino, definitely one of those people. Yeah. I'm not like that far in the De Palma camp. I think like I prefer Hitchcock to De Palma if we're creating that false dichotomy, but
they're comparable in that they both have
so much intention to every shot. There is not a wasted frame in any of these movies. There's no fat on the bone. So you are always goddamn entertained in his movies, even if they don't work 100% of the time.
Yeah. Well, they're just visual experiences where it's like, I don't even necessarily care about the story sometimes. It's just, I know the way he's taking me through this beat is just going to be exciting.
Yeah.
I mean, think of Blowout though. Like there is a scene in Blowout where John Travolta is just recording stuff on a bridge and it's enthralling.
It is the best scene in the movie.
So fucking good.
It's so good.
And this is a guy standing there with a little microphone, just
listening to birds, listening to wind bristle.
It's unbelievable. Yeah. But the fact that he gets that much specificity out of such a nothing moment is incredible. Like, you really have to like point to scenes like that to be like, no, guys, like, yeah, I know his movies weren't always for you, but look at this craft here. Isn't that incredible?
Yeah. And I definitely feel the same way about this. Like, the shot of the Phantom showing up for the first time in the mirror door when Paul Williams is walking down the hallway and then he closes the door and the Phantom shows up. Yeah. And then like we cut to like an aerial shot, like every use of close up, every edit. And it's not just De Palma, by the way. The editor Paul Hirsch worked on this movie. Mm. Paul Hirsch, of course, behind a movie called Star Wars.
I never heard of it.
And The Empire Strikes Back.
They sound like shit. Who names their movie Empire Strikes Back?
Yeah, it's a great point. Like, what?
It's
empire?
An empire. Why does it need to strike back?
I know.
It's what kind of fucking empire?
Jesus Christ. That's lame.
What empire?
Boring. About here?
But one of the great movie editors of all time. And he worked with De Palma a bunch. I think he worked on Blowout and I don't know about Carrie, but definitely the later Mission Impossible movie. It just like this thing is so taut. It's just perfect. It's just like note for note perfect.
Interestingly enough, though, I look at this movie as like before he settled into the school of Hitchcock, because I don't really consider him a Hitchcock impersonator per se. It just seems like he decided I'm going to, you know, study his way of thinking, essentially, or, you know, like I said, just go to the Hitchcock school of thought when it comes to filmmaking. Mm. And he's very upfront about that. So he's not like pretending to be somebody he's not. You know, he feels like a student of Hitchcock.
Well, he talks about that in the documentary, which is what I appreciated about that documentary thing most of all, is he didn't shy away from his influence. He wasn't like, and some guys will do that. Like, if you ask George Lucas about, you know, his impact on cinema in the 70s, I don't think he would be saying like, yeah, I just was ripping off Kurosawa. Like, I don't think he would be forthcoming enough to say that honest and secure enough to say that.
Directors are too insecure. They have their egos to protect, which is why I love it when directors...
Well, Lucas in particular was always like in the shadow of Spielberg and all those other guys. Like, he was always there, but he was like the Ringo.
But he did make Star Wars, guys.
Yeah, no, I know, but...
The documentary actually makes the argument that De Palma is the Ringo. But I think De Palma is like the Ringo that's secretly the Paul, you know? I think that's kind of the take on that is he was the sort of redheaded stepchild. He was making like weird cult sex movies when Scorsese was making Mean Streets, right?
Mm-hmm.
And when Spielberg was making Jaws, he never got the budgets that the rest of them did. He never got the box office returns the rest of them did. And he, unlike the rest of them, embraced flops. And was okay with failure. And, you know, in some ways, like, he sought out movies that he knew weren't going to be like smash successes at the box office. I think I definitely have grown to appreciate the guy more and more over the years. I mean, I've always liked Carrie and I've always liked Mission Impossible. And
I don't think I've seen a single, I don't care for Mission to Mars, but I haven't really seen a De Palma film that I hated, you know?
Yeah.
And I would say there are more hits for me on his list than misses. I mean, there are like, geez, I don't know what the Dressed to Kill's phenomenal.
So you like weird shit like this movie. Like, this movie arguably should be considered a flop, but you like it.
Well, to my point, though, it's not his best film. Like, is it like Blowout?
It's up there, though.
Blowout might be his best. Blowout or Dressed to Kill are fantastic.
Carrie's.
Yeah, Blowout might be my favorite. But damn. Yeah, no, but this...
These are great movies. Now you're running them down. I'm like, oh, actually, shit. This guy's fucking Hitchcock.
And I'm that guy. I'm sorry. I know I feel like I'm in the minority with this, but the first Mission Impossible is actually my favorite Mission Impossible. And a lot of that is
I love them all.
It's because of his direction, though. It's like, this is the one movie that feels like it was made by, like, a visionary auteur filmmaker.
Yeah.
But I will say, like, you know, this is just like a transportive experience. It's sort of like specifically dated in a very fascinating way where the dated qualities don't bother me because I literally feel like I'm being transported to the art scene in New York at that time and just being invited into this club that I shouldn't have been invited into, but I'm there anyway. And boy, what a trip it is. And it's I just think this is just a wonderful experience of a film. Like, I just can't describe anything else like it. So I'm happy I saw it for that reason alone. Like, it's just something totally new for me.
I think it's towards the top on my De Palma list.
It's
towards the top. I like it better than The Untouchables. I like it better than Carlito's Way. I like it better than Scarface.
It's like tied with Scarface for me.
He seems to have made like a weird transition, like around the time of Scarface, into like more action from horror. I don't know if I want to call it horror, but like surrealist kind of.
Well, the 80s are defined, Body Double and Dressed to Kill are, you know, two erotic thrillers that...
But, like, I could see how Dressed to Kill is similar to this or Carrie more than how this movie is similar to Scarface. And after Scarface, that's when he starts making, I feel like you have, like, I haven't seen all these movies, so I can only go off of just what I know about them, which you have, like, Untouchables, Carlito's Way, Mission Impossible, obviously. I've seen that, but
it makes, seems... Well, he makes three gangster movies, so he's kind of known as like a... And they're all... Or two of them are with Pacino, one of them is with De Niro, so like they're... You know, he's making Goodfellas, right? But it's not quite Goodfellas.
But it seems like something happened where he sort of became in the mainstream and like went down this different path for a little while.
Yes. And I don't think it worked out too well for Hollywood.
And then I see in 2006 he made Black Dahlia. So it looks like at some point he made a decision to kind of go back.
Well, they let him make Snake Eyes with Cage in 98, which is a movie that we need to do as well.
Have you seen Snake Eyes?
I haven't. Oh, but, boy. I haven't seen it. Yeah. And yeah, as you said, Mission to Mars. Yeah, it's weird. Like, he's one of these guys that he works within the studio system, but like, you know, he should have never left the indie scene. I mean, that's sort of, he's like sort of invaded this space and they sort of never were able to kick him out. It's like a squatter that's lived on your property for too long. It's like, what do we do about this guy?
Well, he lives in the attic, but he also mows your lawn.
Sure.
And you're like, well, you know, is he that bad?
Yeah. But he's so good at what he does. Like, this is the thing about this movie, is that it has those highly ambitious cinematic set pieces to explain like a simple action,
right?
Like someone trying to show themselves to the guy up above for the first time, like the rotating shot scene of Will Finley when he's playing the piano for the first time, or like we described earlier, just the rotating room scene. And the funny thing about him is that like these are things that I, you know, you conceptualize it in a room, but it feels very like, I don't know, almost like this improvisational fly on the wall sort of thing. You're just like, let's just try it. But when De Palma does it, it's meticulously constructed in the way that like a David Lynch, like hyper weird set piece is meticulously constructed. Whereas like a Spielberg wouldn't know how to deal with a moment like this probably. Or, you know, even a Scorsese would maybe do something similarly ambitious, but he wouldn't, I don't know, wrangle it as rigidly as like, you know, like what a Hitchcock or De Palma might do. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, no, for sure. All right. Do we want to get into the specifics here of this movie?
Sure.
All right. Let's do it. Nick,
you want me to go through the plot?
Yeah, let's do it.
Sure. So, we are introduced to a few characters. Here's a couple things that I think the movie, I don't love how it opens up on just giving you all the backstory. I guess it kind of has to set the scene for you.
Rod Serling voiceover. Did you know that?
It did feel very intentional to me though. Obviously it's intentional, but like for setting the mood for this type of fantastical story, it kind of made sense to me.
Yeah. Getting the voice of the Twilight Zone. Yeah.
That helps.
Yeah.
So we're introduced to Swan, who is a, is he British? I'm starting to second guess myself here.
No. That's not.
Where does this movie take place?
I think a lot of it seems to take place.
I think it's in the U.S.
In the U.S. somewhere.
But they say like he brought the blues to England and brought something to America. I forget, whatever. He's essentially like a Beatles type figure, right? That's the impression I get.
He is based heavily off of Phil Spector. Yes, the famed record producer that like murdered his girlfriend in the 90s. Yeah. Phil Spector, one of the most iconic sort of record producers of that era, worked with like pretty much fucking everybody. Like go down the list. Like, yeah, one of the most influential voices in rock music. And also, yeah, I think just died like 6 months ago, I think.
Oh, wow.
He murdered his girlfriend?
Yeah, went to prison for like shot her. It was like a big thing.
Wow. Record producers suck. I just like to say that. They're not good people. I'll point to this guy and David Foster for that. Bastards. Hate him so much.
When did he murder his girlfriend? 2003.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, just like shot her and then like just spent the rest of his life behind bars and then died. Yep, worked with everybody. Associated acts, George Harrison, John Lennon, the Ramones.
Yeah, okay. Yeah,
the whole thing. The Wrecking Crew, Ike and Tina Turner, Righteous Brothers. Yeah.
So he's this big record producer.
But I should say, just to put a fine note on that, was also kind of like a prickly character of music as well. Like, before the murder conviction, like he was always sort of known as like this very powerful sort of leech.
Usually people who commit murder were known beforehand to have been sketchy.
Yes. Yeah, you would think.
It's pretty typical.
But also had like that look, had like that bowl cut hair, and was, you know, always had like two dime pieces around each arm. Mm-hmm. And,
his name is Phil Spector.
Yeah. Well, you don't know anything about Phil Spector, huh?
I've never heard of him. I did not.
Pacino did a movie. It started a movie about him.
Really?
Yeah, it's not very good. But it's okay. HBO. Yeah, it's an HBO TV movie.
Ah, oh, it's one of those things.
Yeah, yeah.
So we're introduced to this character who is known as Swan.
Yes.
In this movie. And we are basically shown like some sort of like tryouts, I guess. People are playing music for him. And we're introduced to the character Winslow Leach, who is our main character.
Yes. Well, sort of.
Sort of?
Sure. I mean, yeah, it's the title of the movie. So.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like about 50% of the way through the movie, suddenly I wasn't rooting for him anymore. You know?
Why? What happened to him?
This movie gave me a weird, I don't know, man. But he's playing, I don't know. He sort of gives me some like Elton John vibes here, I guess. Or
it gives you Elton John.
I felt the same way.
The way he's playing around the piano. Yeah. And the way the camera's spinning around him, it's kind of getting that vibe.
The song itself, I thought, was kind of like 70s pop.
But it's new Elton John, like the voice of Elton John. Like, that's not a young Elton John voice. That's after his
true.
Voice
no,
changed.
That's like what today I think of as Elton John. That's kind of the vibes I was getting here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he's playing his song Faust, which we'll talk about all of the movies that this entire plot is based off of, or not just movies, but stories. And Swan basically, him and his goonies steal this guy's song, and they're going to have a different band known as the Juicy Fruits. So 70s. God.
Love the Juicy Fruits.
He's going to have them play his score for their opening at the Paradise, which is like a New York City club sort of music venue that he's opening up, right? And but they tell Leach, oh, we love your song, we're gonna have you play it, blah blah blah, and they basically go, oh, just give us the music, we'll review it, and we'll get back to you, and they just never get back to him. That's sure. Basically, and this thing probably happened all the time,
I think, still does happen.
Yeah. Well, good point.
Yeah.
Definitely, it's very sketchy but not surprising.
Yeah.
And then Leach basically tries to like track them down and like get a meeting with this big hotshot executive guy that he's never going to get a fucking chance to meet with. And he keeps showing up like, oh, they said they were going to get back to me. I just wanted to check in. And after one too many times of like sticking his nose in the wrong place, they decide to get rid of him, and they beat the shit out of him, pay off the cops to frame him for a crime and send him to prison. In prison, his teeth are removed.
For some reason. What was that about?
I have no fucking clue. His teeth are removed, and he is, like, sent to, like, work in, like, factory. And meanwhile, they're showing, like, oh, the premiere of their new song, Faust. And he, like, just loses it. He's like, this is it. I'm done. Beats up the guards, breaks out of prison, and, does he go to, like, the record company?
Yes.
And he's like trying to destroy the machines, and an accident happens and like burns one side of his face, his eyes coming out. He looks like the Toxic Avenger on one half.
He does, kind of.
He gets crushed in the record press.
Right.
Which probably would have done a lot more damage than it did.
Yeah. But well, it did make him a phantom.
Yeah, but I'm thinking like Sans head, okay?
Yeah.
I'm just saying.
But again, I'm not just making that Toxic Avenger reference as like a haha. Like, I actually think that, like, I mean, see the look of this face, and there's no way it was not like influential later, even in like the Goonies, arguably.
I see
that same kind of look. It's pretty cool. I'm into it.
Quite a bit.
Oh my god, you're so excited for Malignant, aren't you?
I'm so pumped to talk.
I told you.
I'm gonna have to check it out. Next weekend.
Yes, you will. We're talking next week. We're kicking off the spooktacular.
Oh, we start with Malignant? I'm watching it again, baby. I'm watching it again.
Oh, Nick, have you not been spoiled on Malignant yet?
Mm-mm.
Oh, do your absolute best not to get spoiled.
I don't watch anything. I can't get spoiled on things.
All right, okay. Because the memes are out there. That's all I'm saying.
Be very careful.
Be very careful of any malignant memes.
I'm very curious, since you've seen it, how your feelings have changed.
We'll talk.
Oh, boy.
We'll talk.
Oh, boy. So now that he's, like, scarred and disfigured and broken out of prison and presumed dead, they actually show, like, newspaper reports. Winslow Leach sort of adopts the personality of the Phantom of the Paradise. He puts on this weird, like, bird head and a cape, and he, like, sneaks around the theater and just tries to, like, disrupt and ruin every opportunity for them to play his music.
He's just being a gremlin. You know,
yeah, he's just being a fucking creep.
Right. There's like a direct callback to Touch of Evil with the bomb in the car. Like, exactly.
Yeah. That's some of the, like, De Palma old school, you know, Hitchcock tricks or whatever, the Wells tricks. Yeah. There is a lot of, like, De Palma in this, although it does feel like very much like a Rocky Horror Picture Show, like, cult classic thing. There are a lot of screens.
You know what? That split screen was awesome. And, like, movies don't do that anymore.
The split screen?
Yeah.
Yeah. It can feel tacky, I feel like, but it works really well here.
To Hollywood's point, like, yes, it's incredibly difficult to do, and De Palma doesn't even always get it right.
No, I mean, he's kind of known for his split screens. Yeah, he's kind of like the king of the split screens.
I feel like the most modern movie I can think of using it is something maybe like Ocean's 11 or something like that, one of those movies, one of the Ocean's movies. And yes. I don't feel like it was used well. I feel like it was kind of like tacky.
But see, those are kind of in montage. That's the difference. Like, right, Soderbergh will do that where it's like he'll show two different things happening in different locations and it'll sort of just like flip through it like a flip.
But this is a whole scene.
Right. From
two perspectives.
I mean, that's like the climax of Carrie. He does this, but it's like to the extreme. Like, there's four shots at once and like they're constantly flipping a bet from. Yeah. So this one essentially, shows you the same scene just from two different angles. Which is, you know, like Hitchcock did it in, did it a bunch, but he did it naturally, right? Like he would put an artificial barrier in between two things and, he would essentially do that all in camera. There's a scene in Marnie, a movie that we just covered on the other show a couple months ago, where there's a shot of a heist happening. Somebody's stealing from a bank vault. And that's happening.
So one side of the wall.
Exactly. Yeah. That's happening on one side. The other side is the guard like walking past or whatever. That's like really like that's my shit right there. Yeah. Like that to me is the ideal way to do a split screen. But yeah, no, here I think it's used well.
Yeah.
So and we'll explain the scene where he uses, I guess. They are doing the rehearsal for the Juicy Fruits to play his song, and he plants a bomb in this like fake car they have rolling around on the stage, and so we have one perspective of Swan watching the performance, and the other perspective of what's actually happening on the stage, where the guy behind the guy on the stage who's like running the show, he's like, "You get over there, you got to do this." Blah 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 blah. Meanwhile, from Swan's perspective, all we're hearing is the music and the performance. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's what I really liked about it the most, I think, wasn't just the split screen aspect, but like the audio aspect of like we can hear two different perspectives at the same time.
It's like super stressful. Yeah. It just gives you so much anxiety.
Yes. Yes.
And I just love the one guy that's like, I have a bad feeling about this for no good reason. He just has a bad feeling about this. And you can just barely hear what he's saying too.
Yeah.
Until ultimately, it's just thrown on the car and blown
up. And then just the stage blows up. Everybody's dead. I did skip over something, and I'm going to touch back on it now. Before Winslow is, like, sent to prison and everything, he, one of the times where he's trying to meet Swan, he goes to a tryout for a female backup singer, and there's just all these women in line, basically.
Yeah, it's actually hilarious.
It is funny.
There's a line of women that are going into audition, and he's like, next, next, and you just see in, like, the most like fucking assembly line fashion. These women go into the room, are, you know, Swan attempts to molest them, and then it's like instant, like next, next, next,
like
next.
They go in, they lay them down on a couch. He just like gets on top of them.
Yes.
And then it's just next. It's horrible.
Right. Yeah.
Yes, it is.
But like also take some balls to like take those shots in the '70s, you know,
but this was distributed by 20th Century Fox, right?
Uh-huh. I think it was Fox. Yeah.
I would love to talk to De Palma and be like, did you think this was going to be a hit?
Yeah.
Did you honestly think this was going to work? I mean, I love the movie, but Jesus Christ, man, you can't have a scene like that in your movie
right.
and expect it to resonate with audiences.
And or expect one of like your filthy ass like executives at the studio who does this casting couch routine every 2 days.
Because something that people aren't like totally privy to even then. Like people back then when you were like rebelling against like Westerns or like the Big Brother or something because of like Watergate and stuff like that. Like that's something like was in the social consciousness. I don't know if people at that time were aware of how like seedy the music industry was.
Yeah.
So I imagine even seeing stuff like that in the 70s would have made people go like, oh, what the fuck is this?
Yeah. It's heavy handed, but I think this is the other key too about the commentary. It's made by someone who clearly understands the industry and clearly has his own grievances with it. Like it's not the type of movie that could have been written by an outsider.
I don't have an issue with it at all.
And I think that's why sometimes the heavy handedness is okay. It's because, these are still insights that you needed to be in the room for in order to get.
And you also put the heavy handedness in the correct story.
Right.
So a movie like this, yeah, be heavy handed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Also, lesbian orgy. I should say that. There's a lesbian orgy.
Was there a lesbian orgy? I missed that scene.
Sort of. A PG version.
Just a bunch of women just scantily clad just like cuddling with each other.
Well, yeah, they're all just rolling around and then suddenly like Leech is just like in the pile.
that freaked me
remember
out,
when the Leech like, is just suddenly is there. I think like a woman like rolls over and he's just there laying there and he's like, oh, Mr. Swan, we have to talk. And it's like, what's the fuck?
It's so goofy.
It's really silly. But yeah, this is also where he meets Phoenix, which is why I just wanted to mention it. He meets her in line and he listens to her sing and decides she is the only person besides me who is allowed to sing my music. Hmm. And this sort of obsession carries with him into being
obsession.
The Phantom.
See what you did there, Nick. You're so smart.
I'm a genius. carries in. I don't even get the joke. No, he made a movie, right? That's another movie. Yeah. I did get it.
The best part of what you just said, I don't even get the joke.
Well, I get the joke because I know it's a movie he made. I know it's a movie he made, but I don't know anything about it. Never seen it.
It's about an obsession.
Oh. And
it's about snakes on a plane. There you go.
that's a unique concept.
Someone should make a movie called Snakes on a Plane.
Okay.
Do you know that Sam Jackson like signed up to do that movie because it was called Snakes on a Plane? So he signs up for it and they're like, okay, we're gonna change the title now, and he's like, no fucking way, I will drop out of this movie if you change the title. Because literally the only reason I did this is because it's called Snakes on a Plane.
Wow, what are they gonna change it to?
I don't know. It was like fucking Slither. Emergency in air. I don't know.
What does that movie rank on the spectrum of movie titles? It's one of the best.
Yeah, right? Obviously. I mean, definitely if you if you measure like the ratio of title quality to movie quality,
Jaws is number one.
No, because Jaws is a great movie to match
the
great title.
He's saying the title is better than the movie.
I see. Yeah. Oh, okay.
Divide the title quality by quality of the name.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Snakes on a Plane, I think, has to be number one.
Yes, I agree.
Right. What else?
Oh God, good question.
Think about this.
I feel like there's some space ones that'll be like
some space ones.
Yeah.
Human Centipede.
Yeah, that's definitely up there.
Yeah.
No question about it.
It's like all Grindhouse movies. Hobo with a Shotgun is an amazing title.
Well, it's always the title came before the script. That's what it comes down to.
Yeah, Face Off. There you go. Yeah. I don't know if it's that good. It's not better than Snakes on a Plane, but it's a good title.
The title isn't better than the movie. Face Off.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
It's not better than the movie.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
Yeah.
The title has to be better than the movie.
Yeah.
Okay.
Think about it. Well,
otherwise you're dealing with negative numbers.
I guess you're right. That's true.
Okay, so so as the he kills everybody who's trying to play his song, and at this point Swan sees him in the rafters as this happens. In the split screen, we catch Swan noticing him. So Swan basically is just waiting for his meeting face to face. And when he finally catches him, he basically says like, oh, let's make a deal. He says, you know, I'll work with you. You rewrite your song and you can come with me to the tryouts and pick who performs it. basically, and I'll like pay for you to rewrite your, or I'll keep you here, you can rewrite it. And he forces him to agree, makes him sign the contract in blood.
So ridiculous.
And
the contract's great too, by the way. Like the,
oh my God,
the clauses, all items excluded are to be included.
Well, and the contract ends with Swan, it basically is what it says. Like, it expires with him. Yeah. So the contract basically doesn't end until Swan dies, is literally what it says.
Yep. Love it.
Which is hilarious. It's a great dig at like just legalese in the industry.
And also this idea that like even after I've killed you and you've become a phantom, like you're still a slave to me. Like it's only after I've taken your voice completely do I control you.
And that's the thing about the movie, like despite the fact that it's immensely entertaining and also really funny, by the way, we didn't mention that. It's tremendously funny.
Very funny.
But like it's also really creepy.
Yeah.
And, just unsettling. And a lot of that is through the Swan character. By the way, did we talk about Swan Song Records?
No, we didn't.
Hmm.
Yeah, so I actually had this in the notes for after, but we can do it now. That's fine. So they made this thing for $1 million. They sold it to whatever studio, Fox or Warner Brothers, for $2 million.
Mm-hmm.
But they were also hit by a number of lawsuits after the fact. You have to get this thing. Whenever you make a major movie, you get this thing called E&O insurance. It stands for errors and omissions insurance. So this is if you do your job poorly. This is to protect against any lawsuits. So this will pay your legal fees after the fact. So, for example, they did not realize that they were probably going to get sued for ripping off Phantom of the Opera.
Yeah.
They did. They were not aware that they were probably going to get sued for naming the record label Swan Song Records. Because it's an actual record label owned by Led Zeppelin. I think released some of the early Beatles singles. Like it's a big record. So they had to actually go in and change some of the title cards in the movie. They changed it to Death Records in the final cut. But originally it was called Swan Song Records.
But the image is like a dead bird.
Yeah.
But you see in the movie where they went in and changed it after the fact. So there are very obvious like cropped mats just put on top of the logo. So like the scene where he's like Swan is doing like a little like PSA about the new person they're going to get to perform these songs. He's out on the runway strip and he's got this little podium and you can very clearly see the fact that they didn't, the keyframes weren't around at that time, but it wasn't keyed properly so that it would stay put. So the logo is just shaken over where the original Swan Song label was.
But point being, the movie made so little money, not only because it did poorly at the box office, but because they had to pay for all of these lawsuits.
Right.
You'd think that maybe that controversy would stir up some hype. I don't know, but
I don't know at that time. Yeah, I mean, there was also another character in the Marvel comics called the Phantom, and I guess so Marvel hit him with a lawsuit too.
Really? Yeah. Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it was a whole
what? Yeah. That is true. I know about the Phantom, but I didn't know they got sued for that.
This movie is just like explicitly like just taking from other stories, though. Like, it's not meant to be some original story,
sure,
which is not a bad thing either. I'm not trying to dig at it for that. It's using those stories to tell another story.
There is a song in the movie called Faust, and the plot of the movie involves a Faustian bargain.
Yeah. Right.
I think it's pretty explicitly clear. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The Picture of Dorian Gray is another one with
which
we'll get to at the end there. But so Leach is writing this new song for Swan after signing the contract. And meanwhile, Swan is immediately planning to like betray him and get a new singer to play the song, even though Leach is like, only Phoenix can sing the song. I'm going to write the song for her. She can perform it. Swan decides to get this guy named Beef.
Beef.
I love Beef.
I love Beef.
Beef is fucking great.
Beef rules.
Who was that actor? God, he was so good. He was phenomenal in this movie. He's one of my favorite characters.
Garrett Graham.
Yeah, Garrett Graham.
So good. So good.
I don't know how to even like describe this guy.
Well, it's a great little role reversal because he's this just like starts out as this like sex symbol rock star, and then you hear him speak.
When he talks.
When he starts talking.
I don't know how to say this without like offending people.
He is a flamboyant gay man.
There
that is what he is.
Yeah. Well, he's you know, he was actually the most Rocky Horror character in the movie.
Yes,
he reminded me actually a lot of who's the Meatloaf character in Rocky Horror?
Oh God, who is that?
What's that guy's name? It reminded me a lot of Meatloaf. And it's funny that this character's name is Beef.
Yeah. Maybe that was intentional. No,
maybe it was.
Well, it couldn't have been, right?
Yeah.
I don't know.
I mean, listen, he was born Meatloaf. Okay, like his parents had named him that.
Right.
No, he came out of the womb. He said, "My name is Meatloaf."
Yeah, I mean, he can't change your God-given name.
We want to name him Tom. No, listen here, Doctor. I'm Meatloaf. You get that shit right.
I would do anything for love, but I won't do that. Okay.
Oh, Nico.
Too much.
A little bit. That's okay though. I'll give that one to you.
but it's super funny because like he sings like a deep voice, like rock and roll, mm-hmm. and then he talks and he's like, guys, it's just hilarious. The switch. And you see him like curling his hair in scenes, and like he's wearing like a hair net so it doesn't get wet when he takes a shower. Yeah. It's just like this very like obsession with the way he looks, and it's all he's like a prima donna, I guess.
Yes, he is. Yeah,
which is, I think, on purpose. They're just trying to show that the people who they do want in the studio system are kind of like they're fake. They don't have their own artistic voice, really. They're okay with being like just a figurehead.
Mm-hmm. And even after he's threatened, like his life is threatened by the Phantom with a toilet plunger.
Yeah.
It's just so funny.
In a scene where De Palma's like, yes, I'm ripping off Hitchcock.
Oh, sure.
You know?
Absolutely.
Like if you're gonna parody Hitchcock in that moment, go for it. Don't do silly dialogue with a knife. No, do silly dialogue with the toilet plunger. Go ahead.
But
it's the shower scene in Psycho.
Yeah, the shower scene.
In case you haven't seen Psycho.
Catches him in the shower.
I know it's a very obscure film. So.
It's never been redone before, that scene.
Oh, it's been redone.
I know.
That's almost the whole podcast.
It's the joke.
We haven't done that yet.
That's the joke, Adam.
We haven't done...
I'm referring to the remake, Nick. I'm not referring to the ripoffs of Psycho, specifically the remake.
We haven't done the remake.
No.
How have we not done
it? I have no idea, because Jesus Christ. That thing.
Man, if only there was a miniseries coming up where we could talk about that.
Ooh, wow, we're just pulling them all together, aren't we? There it is.
I love it.
We found it.
Yeah, I've never seen the remake. I've only seen the original, so I'm excited.
Well,
no,
you've seen the remake. No, trust me, Nick, you have seen.
Well, I understand it's shot for shot.
And what they change, whatever, we'll get to that.
So can we talk about this like rock number with Beef?
Sure.
Because it's fucking awesome.
What song do they sing in this scene? I actually have them pulled up. Do you want me to play any of these songs?
Why not? They do this awesome onstage performance where like all of the guys, not Beef, but a bunch of other guys wearing like black and white makeup come out and they're playing this intro song and they're like going into the audience with like these predetermined people in the audience who have fake body parts on them. And they're cutting off their body parts and ripping them off and bringing them onto the stage. And then they end up like taking a guy, they cut off his fake head, put him on the stage. And then they like drop it inside of this coffin thing and it raises up and they have like fake electricity strike it and it comes back down and Beef walks out and he looks like a Frankenstein's monster and he's dancing around like Frankenstein's straight limbs. And it is actually awesome. I think it's like a cool performance that I would have loved to watch.
I'll just put this sort of similar underneath the conversation. Somebody super like you.
Jeez, it's quite good. Can I just say this entire number is amongst the most entertaining things I've ever seen?
It's so good.
For the things that Nick was just saying, it is insane, guys. I was enjoying the movie, but I can't express enough how in it I was the moment they cut to this whole number. It was so marvelous, so beautifully unexpected and wacky. my God. And just the directions it goes, like from like this great, like it has like that visual, like musical rhythm where it's just like, it starts really low and creepy and then explodes into this thing of electricity and people are dying. And it's just like all these weird pyrotechnics happening. It's fucking insane. And I love it.
Yeah. Sorry, Nick, I can't hear you while I play the music. So it's, yeah. that's why I didn't mean to get you, but, unlike the other times that I do. Yeah, he's also able to like include so much of the violence that we talked about before under the PG rating, because a lot of that is prosthetic. I mean, the scene ends with a guy getting shot in the head, and there are like very explicit scenes of or instances of violence.
Well, that scene doesn't end with the guy getting shot in the head.
Well, that whole
That's
not
later. Yeah,
I guess that's a good point. Yeah, that is later.
By the way, talk about subversive. Given the guy who was shot in the head, I was like,
yeah,
it's just freaked out. I freaked out when I saw that.
So he is able to, yeah, he gets a lot of that hardcore violence in there.
Yeah.
You know, he also does some smart stuff and includes like soft violence, but
it's still violence though.
It's implied, right? Yeah. All the violence is implied. And that's sort of the key to making a PG movie like this, is you have to imply a lot. You need to show the audience something without showing them that. And well, yeah, the ripping off of like heads in the audience, even though they were prosthetic heads, like you are able to communicate a certain tone without exactly going there.
Yeah.
Yeah. And to add to that, you can hear me now, right?
Yes.
Yeah. To add to that, like the person you're supposed to be like afraid of is Swan in this movie. And just the knowing that this is the tone that he thinks is like appropriate for a show, like it adds to the spookiness of Swan.
Oh yeah.
For like putting on a show where they're cutting off body parts and bringing him on stage, you know?
Mm-hmm. I've never seen, like, I've been to very weird heavy metal concerts, guys, and none of them are even close to this level of insanity.
It would have been the coolest thing to see actually live. And that's another thing.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
For a director or whoever was in charge of like coming up with that idea to include that, like that takes some serious like actual thought and energy towards just that one scene.
And the idea, of course, of the scene too is that it eventually sort of ends up with insane violence, but the audience just sort of thinks that it's part of the show. And that's sort of like the fine line there.
The comment, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, Beef is electrocuted to death.
Yes.
By the Phantom. After being warned, if you perform my song, you will die.
Yep. Yes. And he does, and he follows through.
Yep. But this death on stage, you know, everybody's like, you know, they close the curtains and they pull his body off, and everybody's like cheering like they want more. So they send out Phoenix, not knowing what else to do. And they have her sing, and everybody loves it. She's a hit. A Star Is Born.
Yeah.
And it also gives Swan the idea, well, people love violence. So what I'm going to do is at the next show, I'm going to have Phoenix assassinated live during her performance. That becomes the plot.
Right.
It's ridiculous.
Because he thinks it'll sell records or whatever.
It's fucking insane. This movie's crazy.
Yeah, the amount of like pure evil, like no question.
How do you convince, because you have to convince a lot of people to make a movie like this. How do you get to that part to be like, wait, what, Brian?
So not only, by the way, does he plan on having Phoenix assassinated, but he plans on marrying her on
live,
stage.
Yeah, he's actually marrying her on stage in the performance, and then she will get assassinated the moment she says I do or whatever.
Exactly. Right. So, yeah.
Just Swan, absolutely dude. Batshit crazy.
Swan rules.
Oh, my God.
And yeah, so meanwhile, Phoenix is falling in love with Swan after this performance, and Swan,
it's also implied that Swan is like drugging her.
Yes.
Yeah.
He is. Yeah. Which he does to all of his artists, I think. Mm-hmm. Like
the
Phantom also is like addicted to pain pills or something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that would make sense.
Yeah. There's a scene, right, where he just like, he's like, pills, and
yeah, he's giving
clearing
pills
the pills
so can...
off. Remember the music sheet, like quietly, and then stealing them, and then barricading the guy's little cave, like music cave there with fucking bricks and cement. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yes. right before the big performance, he literally builds a brick wall outside of the door just to like keep the Phantom trapped in that room so that he can't interrupt his plans. But Winslow does break out. He presumably punches through the brick. They don't really show.
I was under the impression he just screamed and then the bricks toppled over.
He did scream and then they did cut back a moment later. So maybe that's an actually interesting.
He's got like sonic boom powers in his voice.
Well, yeah, he literally lost his voice and they gave him like some like computer part that makes his voice come out again. And it's like computer generated almost.
It's a little Darth Vader-y, may I say. There's, I don't know, George Lucas. I don't know. Just saying.
Maybe.
Forget about the Nazis. It was Phantom of the Opera. I mean, Phantom of the Paradise.
yeah. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
And this is when Winslow, he's trying to find... Oh, you know what I skipped over? Winslow sees Phoenix and Swan like together, like kissing and everything, and he decides like this is it, my life is over. He tries to kill himself and he stabs himself in the heart, and then Swan comes up on the roof and just pulls the knife out and he goes, like, you can't die, you signed a contract. Like, you're not allowed to die until I die.
You've gave up your right to rest in peace.
Right. <That's the last. laughs> So once Winslow breaks out of the room, he goes to track down his contract and find a loophole. And in doing that, he actually finds some video records that Swan has kept, including a video of him. Weirdest video. He's sitting in a bathtub, young Swan, and he's like, I've decided to videotape this because I'm going to commit suicide. I am getting old. He's like 27. He's like, I'm getting older. And if I can't stay this beautiful forever, I would rather die now. And this is like the weirdest, like, I'm just trying to think of the circumstances around filming this.
That's what I'm saying.
It's so silly. He sets up a camera to film himself in the bathtub where he gets to look back at the camera. And then there's a mirror in front of him where you can see his reflection. It's like, who would set up a shot like that?
But it's not just, it's like you said, it's what was blowing my mind about that sequence is the fact that the tape in that moment is edited together. So there are shots where you get like a medium of his reflection as the devil in the mirror that he's sitting in front of, which implies that there were cameras set up specifically for that moment.
Or that the devil has his ways.
Oh, it's the devil made the videos.
Yeah, I think. Yeah.
You think so? Okay.
In the mirror reflection of the bathtub, basically, a dark, evil version of him begins talking back to him, saying, well, if you want to stay young forever, just sign this contract in blood.
Right.
And so it's like, okay, so he is the devil. He made a deal with the devil. He's the Faust character. Yep. So we know who the Phantom of the Opera is. We know who the Faust character is. Mm. He's also the Dorian Gray character because part of the contract that he makes is as long as these tapes survive, he will stay young forever. Basically, the tapes age, not him, which is exactly what the picture of Dorian Gray is about. Winslow burns, sets fire to like the whole room, basically, all of the tapes, and he leaves to go stop the assassination. The guy's setting up the gun about to shoot Phoenix, and he moves the gun at the last second, and it kills officiant for the wedding, which is one of Swan's like top guys, who's basically just been like, you know, doing all the grunt work for the whole movie.
Yeah,
whatever.
Every time I see an image of a priest getting shot, it's just, I know, maybe it's a me thing, but it always just throws me off.
There's no way that guy was like an officiant though, right? Like, he went and got his fucking license, like,
probably signed up online.
Yeah,
did a little 10 minute
online in the 70s.
Yeah, whatever.
We have friends who became officiants in about 5 minutes. It's okay.
In the 70s.
Yeah, in the 70s, that's right.
But yeah. And then Winslow goes and he stabs Swan. And as soon as Swan begins to die, Winslow also begins to bleed from his previous wound in accordance with the contract, right?
Yeah. And then everybody dies.
And everybody dies.
It's this whole, like, circle of life thing. It's like, yeah, the only reason that this record executive is, like, authoritarian is because he's under the control of somebody even higher up the chain. So it's this, like, never-ending cycle of puppet masters pulling the strings, right?
Yeah.
You're all fucked.
So that's the whole fucking plot. I know, it's kind of a lot, but this movie just, like...
It's bonkers.
It's weird. I also think that that entire like assassination combat fighting scene, whatever, the chaos after the shot is fired, mm-hmm. was like maybe some of the most like arguably shaky cam I've ever seen for like a 70s movie.
But it's all controlled. I mean, that I think that's the thing about it. Is,
yeah, it's
is
not there quite is a Michael Bay levels.
Yeah, well, there is a lot of chaos in it, but there is still that De Palma like steady hand behind the camera. And I think that's what I just loved about this movie so much.
Yeah, well, control, I would say, like, there's confidence in the chaos, or rather there's a lot of intentionality to it. It's, I mean, there's invariably going to be things that you can't control when you're just having everyone run around and be hysterical.
Yeah.
So, but it's, you know, the direction is very, very specific in that moment, regardless. I agree. So,
Okay. That's basically the plot. I did have a couple other notes.
please. I know that was a lot, but
yeah,
this movie is fucking wild.
Just a little behind the scenes for you. The movie was sort of came about because Brian De Palma was in an elevator and he heard a like soft jazz version of a Beatles song. And he's like, oh, if the record industry can do this to the Beatles, then like, you know, something is fucked up. So that's what got all the ball, got the ball rolling on this plot. You know, essentially of like, you know, how these record executives take something so beautiful and so ambitious and literally strip your voice away. We should mention that the Phantom later in the movie, he loses his voice and he has to be plugged into these machines pre-auto tune and everything. But he has to be plugged into the console in order to like have a listenable voice. And that voice is the voice of Paul Williams. So we should say that. So essentially, like, this idea that you need the studio in order to speak, literally.
Well, and yeah, and the whole time they keep saying, like, Swan says he wants to take Phoenix's voice. He says, like, all you have to do is give me your voice.
Yeah.
And obviously, I think, like, you know, there's the literal voice that they're taking, but there's also the figurative voice, like their choices and their artistic decisions.
Mm-hmm. Of course. But it's this whole idea that all these different genres, from rock to like, you know, the sort of Beach Boys sound with the, what's that, the band called? The Juicy Fruits. Like all that stuff. It's, there's an evolution to music. There's like this emo rock at the end of it, right? There's all this evolution, but it's all still this prepackaged, very planned, artificial thing. So yeah, that's sort of the behind the scenes on that. I mentioned that it was nominated for Best Original Score. This is Nicolas Cage's favorite De Palma movie.
I believe it.
Yeah, that checks.
That follows.
And the lead was almost played by one John Voight. What do you think about that?
What, the Phantom?
Yes. No, sorry, the Swan character was almost John Voight.
Not as good. Would still be interesting, I think.
The question is does Williams still write the music in this instance?
Right? Probably. He should.
Yeah, he should.
I would hope so.
God, the music is so good. I'm going to play a little of the Phantoms theme because this is like, this song is fucking gorgeous, dude. Let me just jump it about halfway through. That I've been on the devils that disturb me and the angels that defeated them somehow. Come together. Me now. Paul Williams. Dude, I was listening to some Paul Williams last night and I scared my cat. It's about 2 a.m. I just finished the movie and I'm like, I just need to pull up some Spotify and just like listen to Paul Williams on the Daft Punk album. And I was fucking jamming out and my cat was staring at me as though I had 3 heads.
She's never seen you do that before.
He. Don't misgender my cat.
Look who's talking.
Yeah, so the Daft Punk thing is interesting. Random Access Memories features Paul Williams, I think, on 2 of the tracks. He is actually on the song Touch. He's the main vocal on that song Touch. Mm-hmm. And I think wrote the song Beyond, I think. You have to check me on that. He's not featured on it, but you can hear him on the song Touch. What a, just straight up my favorite songs of all time, that song. You ever heard it?
No.
touch.
That album is just so fucking good.
It's unbelievable.
We've talked about this many times, except for the song that it's known
the
for.
The song that everybody knows, right? Get Lucky is like the big single, and yeah.
That song fucking blows.
Blows. But Touch is incredible.
Yes.
And so Paul Williams wrote that thing and ended up winning a Grammy for it.
Deservedly.
Daft Punk, the French duo, met each other at a theater at a screening of Phantom of the Paradise.
No.
Wow. Yes.
Holy shit.
Yes.
That you're telling me they watched this movie and they're like, what if we looked like that?
Yeah.
And wrote music. Wow. That was like, that's, you can't even say that this movie was not the inspiration for Daft Punk then. You
they
can't even
met.
Make the argument.
They
you
wouldn't make meet. The they wouldn't know each other.
It's you an influential make, movie.
Oh look my God. That.
Responsible for putting Daft Punk together, and then years later they bring Paul Williams in to work on Random Access.
Can you
memories?
Imagine they go watch wow. this movie, meet yeah. each other, decide to look like the character, and later they're famous enough that they can actually just get Paul Williams?
Yeah,
that's amazing.
That is crazy.
Right? And they bring him in and do like the best song on the album with him, and it's great. It's just phenomenal. It's just like it's amazing. Like some of those behind the scenes like happy accident stories.
That's cool.
But this movie was really big in France and really big in Canada and did horrible here. So I think it was like it played in France for a number of years. And that's why, you know, those two crazy French fucks would have run into each other at a movie theater at some point.
That's really amazing.
I know. Isn't that awesome?
Yeah.
Listen to Touch. I recommend everybody listen to Touch. Man, the guy is just like fucking great. And wrote, I think, probably my favorite movie song of all time.
This is your favorite movie song?
No, Rainbow Connection, I think.
Rainbow Connection's your favorite. That's right, yeah.
I think, is that my favorite?
That's your favorite movie song?
What's your favorite movie song?
I have no idea. It's not Rainbow Connection, but...
Huh.
I don't know. Do musical numbers from, like, actual...
Sure.
Like from a musical count?
No.
Okay, oh.
I think they have to be songs written for movies, right? I guess Lose Yourself, maybe?
Live and Let Die?
Dies up there.
Skyfall.
A lot of the Bond ones are.
Yeah, a lot of the Bond.
Good.
Skyfall's really good.
I think I like Rainbow Connection better.
I love
the Muppets.
I'll pull up a list.
I love the Muppets.
Do you want me to pull up a list of someone else's 20 best songs written for movies?
Sure.
I've Seen It All from Dancer in the Dark.
Okay.
Danger Zone, Top Gun.
Ooh.
No.
I don't like that song.
You Can Never Hold Back Spring, Tiger in the Snow. Never heard of this. Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head. Yeah, me either.
Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head was written for what?
Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
Right. Ooh, yeah.
Interesting. Okay.
Porpoise Song by the Monkees for Head.
Okay.
I don't know. Moon River, Audrey Hepburn, Breakfast at Tiffany's.
Moon River, great song.
Lose Yourself by Eminem for 8 Mile, ooh, apparently. Okay. Mm-hmm. I did not know that was written for 8 Mile.
Yes, it was. Yeah.
That's really cool.
Closing credit song.
Cat People, Putting Out Fire, David Bowie.
I think one best original song at the Oscars that year, Lose Yourself, and Barbara Streisand presented the award. It was either Barbara Streisand or Bette Midler, I'm not sure. And when she opened the envelope, she was like visibly disgusted.
Really?
Like this hip hop garbage won the award that I've won like 5 times.
Oh God.
Yeah, it was like, why didn't like this like corny power ballad win again? Yeah,
So Cat People by David Bowie for Cat People.
Uh-huh.
Exit Music for a Film by Radiohead for
yes,
Romeo
for,
and Juliet.
For, yeah. Yes. I forgot that was a movie song. Yeah, that's why it was called Exit Music for a Film off OK Computer.
Okay.
Fight the Power, Public Enemy for Do the Right Thing.
Do the Right Thing, yep.
Yeah. We Are Sex Bob by Beck for Scott Pilgrim.
Oh, good one. Good one.
Can't Help Falling in Love, Elvis Presley for Blue Hawaii.
That's it.
Did not know that.
That's
I did not know
that's
that.
That's not a movie song.
That's it. There it is.
What the fuck is Blue Hawaii? That doesn't count.
No, that's it. If that's true, that's
it
the
was
one.
Written for the movie?
That song
All right,
is...
does Purple Rain count then?
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, yeah. Wouldn't it?
See, I don't... Yeah, I don't know.
Let me keep going, though. If
I don't
you want
like,
to
like
sing-
Purple Rain is a song in a musical with, you know, like, that the album is more famous than the movie.
I don't think it matters.
All right. What else you got here?
If You Want to Sing Out, Sing Out by Cat Stevens for Harold and Maude.
Ooh, that's a tender, beautiful song.
And one of my favorite movies ever made.
Yeah, mine too.
No, not there, though. Not Rainbow Connection. Yeah, we haven't.
I'm Easy, Keith Carradine for Nashville.
Fuck Nashville.
Save Me, Amy Mann for Magnolia.
Don't remember the song.
Me neither.
Okay. Miss Misery, Elliot Smith for Good Will Hunting.
Is that for this movie?
Is it? I guess. Yeah. This is the thing. Are you sure these are for, I don't know. Maybe.
I don't think so. I don't think that was written for the movie.
It says the legacy of Good Will Hunting for launching a then unknown Elliot Smith's career.
Yeah, the song came out before the movie. It is no, yeah.
Okay, so it made the song famous, though?
Yeah, it's like it's that breathy, like, love theme they play when he breaks up with
the See, they're saying,
girlfriend.
Don't You Forget About Me for The Breakfast Club.
I just found my number one, by the way. It's Mrs. Robinson.
That's the number one on this list, too.
Yeah.
Simon Garfunkel, Mrs. Robinson.
There you go.
Okay, yeah, actually written for the movie. Fair enough.
Yeah.
Knocking on Heaven's Door, Bob Dylan for Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid.
Yeah, for Billy the Kid, yeah. He wrote the whole soundtrack for that.
So.
And what else? Huh?
That's it.
Rainbow Connection isn't on this list?
No.
Oh, you fools.
You fool.
You fool.
I mean, this is just one list.
I love that Rainbow Connection.
I do. It's one of my favorite. Somewhere Over the Rainbow isn't on that list.
Ooh, that's a great one. Yeah. Well, that's kind of weird. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Maybe that we're talking about musicals then, though. So I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
Let me look at AFI's. Not to beat a dead horse here, but let me look at AFI's list real quick.
That's the problem, though. When we're talking about musicals, the list gets very complicated.
Over the Rainbow, number one.
Yeah.
As Time Goes By, Casablanca, number two.
Okay.
Fair enough.
Yes.
Singing in the Rain, number three. Again,
that's what I'm saying. Yeah.
Moon River's number four. White Christmas is number five. Mrs. Robinson, number six. When You Wish Upon a Star from Pinocchio, number seven. Mm. The Way We Were from The Way We Were, Barbara Streisand. Staying Alive, is that a movie song? I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it is written. Yeah.
The Saturday Night Fever, yeah, that appeared on the Saturday Night Fever soundtrack first. And then The Sound of Music for The Sound of Music. I don't agree with that one.
Of course you don't.
That song kind of blows. Like, hold on. Without the context of the movie, that song kind of blows.
In the context of the movie, it's even worse.
You both can fuck off. How about that?
It's I don't know, man.
Shut up.
I was snoozing to that shit in music class. So we're watching
that movie.
Born to Be Wild from Easy Rider.
I don't like that song.
The Shaft theme.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, they get kind of obvious.
Why is Rainbow Connection not on this list? Goldfinger. Okay. Not as good as Live and Let Die. Gonna Fly Now? Okay.
No one likes Rainbow Connection, Nico.
I don't get it. That's number one with a bullet for me. Summer Nights.
Play us out to it.
Rainbow Connection is number 74 on AFI's list. What the fuck?
You gonna divorce yourself from AFI now?
It's like three spots ahead of 9 to 5.
Oh, no.
All right. I'm not going to. Okay. Whatever.
We're not going to give the number one spot to a couple of fucking Muppets.
There are some songs in Emmett Otter, though, that might be even better.
Oh, God.
You got to watch that Emmett
Stop
Otter.
It with this Emmett Otter.
Oh, Emmett
Otter. It's creeping
sick.
Me out. It is creeping
Paul
me out.
Paul Williams did every song. I love Paul Williams. Oh, one more anecdote. As a young boy, this 16-year-old kid showed up to a show that Paul Williams was doing in Mexico City. Paul Williams is, you know, singing a bunch of like his famous songs from the movies that he'd composed. And this kid comes up to him and is like, here, will you sign my record? And the record is a Phantom of the Paradise soundtrack. And so he signs it. And he says, who am I making this out to? And the guy's like, please make it out to Guillermo del Toro.
Wow.
Guillermo del Toro showed up, 16-year-old boy, to this Mexico City show. Years later, they're doing a Pan's Labyrinth theatrical adaptation with songs. And who scores that damn thing? None other than Paul Williams.
That Paul Williams.
So it's all this full circle. He's influenced so many people. And it's just like this great. I fucking love Paul Williams. We're playing Rainbow Connection on the way out of here.
Please do.
I love him. All right. Anything else about this movie?
Oh, man.
I don't know, man. I feel like this is one of those movies that I wish I was warned going into. I feel like I feel like I need to know what I'm getting into sometimes. And that's just being just thrown into the deep end for this one is a little tricky. So
no, that's fair. I wasn't sure how I had a feeling Nico was going to love it. I was not sure how you were going to react to it, Nick, at all. It's definitely one of those movies. Like I said before, it's like if you, I don't know, if this isn't your thing, I could imagine your reaction would be akin to like throwing, I don't know, dry ice into a pool of lava, which is not a good reaction.
I don't think I hated it. No, it was just so bizarre. I don't think, honestly, people would hate this movie. I just think they would find it so bizarre that they tune out.
I don't know. I think people could hate this movie quite easily.
Yeah.
I get it if you do. I just feel bad for you if you do. That's all.
Yeah, I don't know. But this is like one of those things where it's like, this happens sometimes in the show, is I come out of these conversations liking the movie more.
And you need to talk your way through it sometimes.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of movies that I sit and I let it percolate in the back of my head for a few days before I know how I feel about it.
Like Pink Flamingos.
Like Joker. Joker's a great one. The movie fucking sucks, but I thought it was good for a second.
I'm the only one who's now on this pod thinks it doesn't suck. I don't love the movie, of course, but yeah, it doesn't suck. Come on.
Yeah, it kind of sucks.
Nah,
all right.
No, it doesn't. Get over yourselves.
Let's play a game. Paul Williams, let's go, baby. Paul Williams has been, featured in numerous soundtracks over the years. Is a, I believe, the president of ASCAP.
Is that right?
Yeah, has been for I think like 15 years, the Music Writers Association. Yeah, Paul Williams.
These guys always flummox me, though. I don't know. It's hard to judge.
If you pull up his IMDb here, he's got 90 acting credits and 194 soundtrack credits.
Ooh, wow.
So his music has been recycled over the years many a times. And I'm sure is responsible for some of your favorite songs, whether you know it or not.
Yeah.
I mean, it's easy to say that this guy is as influential to music as many famous musicians, even though, like, you don't think of him as a typical musician necessarily.
Nick, the guy wrote the Love Boat theme.
That's
all you gotta know.
Yeah.
Fucking wrote the Love Boat theme. Is there any single piece of art as influential as the Love Boat theme?
I don't know.
I can't sing the Love Boat theme off the top of my head.
It's like, da-da-da, the Love Boat. I don't know.
So, I'm just trying to... How much does he work?
I want a soundbite of what you just did.
Put it on the soundboard.
I don't know. It's the fucking Love Boat.
What the fuck is it? I don't know what it is. You're such an idiot.
Love. Exciting and we're expecting you, and love, life's sweetest reward. Let it flow.
Nico, you were not even close.
I'll go first. I'll say $70 million. I'll say $70
million. Okay.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So Drew Carey's worth $180 million?
Yeah, I think we've established that. But
yeah.
Yeah. Anybody else?
Your turn, Nick. I'm going last.
Okay, two Drew Carey's.
Two. Oh. Well,
ooh.
360.
I'm boxing myself in. I was going one.
I was going to go a lot higher, but with Nico going low, I don't need to. Yeah.
Going one. 1-1.
Okay. I'm seeing two radically different numbers.
Oh, no.
So I don't know which one to go with.
What's our typical source?
Yeah.
I don't know. The
look up multiple sources and see which is the average.
Didn't we always go to... No, not the average. They're radically different.
The medium.
I'll stick with celebritynetworth.com. Even
that's what we've always used, right?
Yeah, I think that they lie about everything.
I think so too, but we've established that.
So this one says $14 million. What? So we'll go with that. I just won this week's.
Wow. What are the other numbers then?
Yeah, it's like, I saw 185 somewhere else.
So that's also a win for Adam.
Wow. Well, I lose then. Really, it's not about who won. It's about who lost.
God damn
it. Nick, you lost this week's edition of.
We're sharing that point, Nico.
All right.
This is Adam. He just gets a really long straw, and I drink your
milkshake. Oh, such a good movie. Have you watched that yet, Nick?
Yes.
Oh, okay, good.
Before I even met you.
Really? I didn't know this.
Get out of here.
It's not your kind of movie.
I've seen an assortment of films.
Okay.
Are you excited for Licorice Pizza?
Licorice Pizza?
Yeah.
What is that?
It's the new Paul Thomas Anderson film.
Oh.
It's called Licorice Pizza.
That's a great name.
I guess obviously I'm going to check it out, you know. Is it coming out this year?
Is indeed.
Cool. Licorice Pizza.
It follows a high school student becoming an actor in the 70s.
Played by Philip Seymour Hoffman's son.
Oh.
Cooper Hoffman?
Yes. Oh, that's going to feel weird.
Yes.
Nick, as an anime fan, have you seen the trailer for
not
the...
Not an anime fan.
Whatever. Okay. Have you seen the trailer for the live-action Cowboy Bebop?
No.
Yep, Cowboy Bebop.
Don't know anything about Cowboy Bebop.
Oh, I would have thought you would.
No.
Yeah, it looks interesting.
Everybody thinks I like anime. I like sushi. Let me be clear. Like, I like ramen. Food.
You showed us that fucking School Days thing, and then there's Death Note.
Yeah, but someone showed that to me. I didn't go out of my way to watch that shit. That thing's awful.
You have to understand, like, to those who are not into anime, anyone who shows anybody anything from anime, we think, this guy's, you know, a big anime nut. That's just how it is. Am I wrong?
I guess that's fair.
What would you say, Nico?
I say, as a Jet fan, I need to get going. Love you very, very much.
That's so much sadder.
I don't know. It's whatever.
Wish him all the luck.
Yeah.
He doesn't have any.
God, we're so awful this year, guys. We've yet again blown our top quarterback pick. Yet again, we've drafted the wrong guy, and yet again, I'm stuck in 5 years of purgatory.
As someone who lives in the city of the Bengals, I am sympathetic.
At least your guy hit. At least he's good.
I went to a bar not so long ago, and I ordered my drink, and they have football playing, and of course the Jets are on, and they are just stinking. They suck. I'm just going like, cheers, take my drink, and that's that.
Four rookie quarterbacks in the history of the NFL have had games with zero touchdowns and four interceptions. Three of them are Jets quarterbacks. That's all you need to know. Until next time, you've all been so very, very naughty.
Naughty.
Dreamers and me.